D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Katrin Ohlendorf. Guten Abend. Die erste Liebe bleibt in besonderer Erinnerung, so heißt es. Aber ist das wirklich so? Ist die erste Liebe nicht viel eher durch die Erinnerung erst besonders? Das kann man auch nicht ganz so sagen, denn sogar wer noch keine erste Liebe erlebt hat oder sich dessen nicht bewusst ist, hat ja eine Vorstellung davon, wie sie sein muss oder wie sie sein wird. Und das ist nicht zuletzt so, weil die Literatur uns Bilder der ersten Liebe liefert. Die erste Liebe, ihre Darstellung und ihre Natur waren Thema der Tagung First Love on Second Thought. Das Potsdamer Einstein-Forum hatte im Januar 2012 Wissenschaftler verschiedener Disziplinen und Literaten dazu eingeladen, einen zweiten Blick auf die erste Liebe zu werfen, um mal den Vortragstitel sinngemäß zu übersetzen. Gestern hat uns der Philosoph Rüdiger Zill mit Textbeispielen gezeigt, wie die erste Liebe ab dem Ende des 18. Jahrhunderts als literarisches Thema Konjunktur hatte und wie sie zur Sprache kommt. Heute knüpfen wir dort an. Die US-amerikanische Literaturwissenschaftlerin Maria DiBattista, Professorin für Englisch und vergleichende Literaturwissenschaft in Princeton, begibt sich in Texten von Beckett und Turgenev auf die Spur der ersten Liebe. Ihren Fokus legt sie dann aber weniger auf die positiven Seiten, also Glück oder Hoffnung, sondern sie legt ihr Augenmerk auf die ekstatische Gleichgültigkeit, die in der Literatur als Merkmal der ersten Liebe oft auftaucht, wie sie sagt, und folgt diesem, ihrem zweiten Gedanken zur ersten Liebe, dann bis zum letzten, dem Tod. First Love and Last Things hieß dann auch ihr Vortrag, den sie am 27. Januar 2012 gehalten hat. Eine kurze Vorbemerkung noch. DiBattista spricht ein sehr gut verständliches Englisch, aber durch die Fachsprache ist es auch manchmal etwas anspruchsvoll. Wenn Sie den Vortrag also nochmal nachhören wollen, können Sie das gerne tun. Wie alle Hörsäle finden Sie auch diesen auf unserer Homepage dradiowissen.de.
Well, thank you very much and thank you for listening to me in English. And before anything else, I would like to thank the organizers, particularly Rüdiger, for this invitation, and also express my appreciation for the opportunity and the wit provided by the conference title, First Love on Second Thought. I think it invites a healthy skepticism about the prestige and even the validity of anything that presents itself as first, especially anything as subject to revision, sentimentalization, or regret as human love. Second thoughts suggest, too, a more dispassionate and considered reaction to what initially seemed reassuringly transparent experience. Second thoughts impress us as thoughts reflecting the more measured calculations of reason rather than the impulsive promptings and the hurried rationalizations of the heart. Without doubt, then, second thoughts are usually very good things to entertain, unless and until they slide into a complacent or superior knowingness. This admonition, I hope to convince you, is especially pertinent on this occasion and with this subject, since it is the very idea of knowingness that First Love mounts one of its most serious and, I think, successful challenges. I think we can see how important the idea of questioning knowingness is in the beginning of Beckett's First Love. I think it accounts for the note of quiet defiance, but defiant nevertheless, that penetrates his sort of opening declarations. I associate, rightly or wrongly, my marriage with the death of my father in time. So in that opening, what you have is, in fact, encapsulated the whole narrative of First Love, connecting the death of the father, the expulsion from the family unit, the going out into the world, which he, being Beckett, associates with a kind of eviction, an ensuing marriage, and in time, again, puts the imprint that this is a narrative, not necessarily a sort of lyrical account. But the rightly or wrongly, okay, there's the note of defiance, rightly or wrongly, in some sense, the story is beyond objective determinations. It's right or it's wrong, but there the story sort of stands as a kind of affront or a challenge or certainly a kind of riddle. And he concludes that other links exist on other levels between these two affairs is not impossible. I have enough trouble as it is trying to say what I think I know, again, the kind of hesitation. So I wanted to begin with what it is we think we know about first love. It seems to me, in listening to so many of the talks that preceded mine, that the answer, at least initially, has to center with a certain kind of interest and perhaps apprehension on where one, in fact, puts the stress on first love. That is, on the first, as a kind of adjective denoting quality, perhaps even the rank of the experience, or on the noun, love, the essence or the character of what people are feeling. I would suggest that for the moderns, who arguably made first love their primary erotic myth, the emphasis falls on the first, since it is then and it is there that love separates itself out from infatuations, what we've called crushes, dalliances, or even full-blown love affairs that, however diverting, however cherished, can only confirm, at best expand, but do not substantially transform our sense of who we are or what life is. The first love may not be, although it often is, one's great or one's only love, but it must be felt and remembered as an epical moment, often but not necessarily on the brink of maturity, a moment that ushers us into a transfigured world and, in a sense, enraptures us with a new and initially exultant apprehension of reality. It's very interesting sort of seeing the genealogies, cultural genealogies, literary genealogies that are emerging in the discussion of first love. And from the last paper, going back to Petrarch, I would say that Dante's La Vita Nuova is also one of the paradigm cases where first love initiates a vocation, but the vocation itself is founded in what I call a new and exultant apprehension of reality, a sense that the world is ordered otherwise than we initially thought. But let me go to a more concrete example. It seemed to me that I had known her for a long time, and that before I had known nothing and had not lived. Such is the vivid recollection of Vladimir Petrovich, the aging bachelor who recounts his first love in Turgenev's novella of the same name. Vladimir is, in fact, only 16 when he meets and falls romantically, if childishly, in love with Zinaida, the bewitching young woman who has captured his attention and his heart in one swift movement. So that this impression of long acquaintance expresses an emotional rather than an historical reality. As such, it appears as a sign that Vladimir, in the course of a few hours, has not only entered into a new state of being, but already mentally as well as emotionally settled into a new environment for which, like a fish in water, as he himself puts it, he is spiritually perfectly adapted. To those like Vladimir, newly arrived but not unfamiliar with its reputation, the world of love is where happiness dwells, where souls are in instant and complete rapport with each other, and where everything that matters, that is known or will be known. If Vladimir initially feels at home and is happy in that world as a fish in water, it is because he is oblivious to the likelihood, as he seems to be of the metaphor, of troubled waters, where in fact he will soon find himself. First love, then, we could say, marks the end of one kind of epistemological innocence and the beginning of another. And it is the second innocence that gives love its warm emotional coloration, its hope, and its moral courage against anything that questions or opposes it. This innocence and this initial euphoria, however short-lived, or however ironized by second thoughts that subsequent and concrete experience bring, nonetheless affects a permanent alteration in the way life is seen and experienced and lived. After the first, nothing remains what and how it was. All that made the realm of before and all that will come to comprise the realm of after no longer seem to be connected. They are severed. What the self and indeed the world had become, or more actually what the world has shown itself to be, are the questions that the literature First Love sets out to answer and finally to pronounce judgment upon. And of course, it's this moment of first love as a moment, an epical moment, not only of entry, but of separation, that I think both Evan and remarks last night about first love being a narrative, essentially of subject formation, when the subject becomes, and it's complemented by Rüdiger's remarks that first love emerges at a state when we are finally aware enough of ourselves and environment to greet it and to understand it as such. Thereafter, however, all agreement seems to end, at least about the nature of the first. It's interesting how we kind of obsessively, as well as repetitively, come back to this idea of the first. Stendhal, an ardent chronicler of love, stresses the fatefulness of the first as that mot terrible in his amatory lexicon. A, the author aesthete of the either-or volume of Kierkegaard's Either-Or, which we encountered this morning, rhapsodizes, and here I'm quoting again what we saw, again in my English, the first is so beautiful because it suggests the primitive in love, for it is not in the numerical sense that one speaks of first love, unquote. Except that one has and one does speak of first love in the numerical sense, especially if one is concerned less with the aesthetic beauty and more with the ethical impact of the first. The moral and the social sciences have recently showed little interest and less appreciation in first love as a character and life-defining experience, but now with a renewed and a large understanding of the role of emotions in our moral and social development, this is no longer the case. And just to refer, I'm not going to develop this point, but sort of pick up again what Eva mentioned last night, a recent book that came out in England in 2010, which concludes that, in fact, first love is absolutely deleterious to any kind of mature, further human relationships. And I want to just repeat that line because it seems to me a kind of a provocation, but also a slight misunderstanding of what the first and first love is actually trying to communicate. The editor and the sponsor of this volume of essays called Changing Relationships concludes that it seems that the secret to long-term happiness in a relationship is to skip a first relationship. In an ideal world, you would wake up already in your second relationships. So we have two ideal worlds competing with each other, the ideal world that the first love devises and the ideal world of the sociologist who sees happiness in a completely different register. You probably know where my sympathies are. I do not think we live, and I don't think we can ever hope to wake up already in our second relationships, assuming, of course, that we ever had or even want a first love. In this case, I was thinking of Beckett's reclusive solipsists, heroes, if they can be called heroes, who deny any desire for love at any time, first, middle, or last, which, of course, makes the comedy of their capitulation all the more pronounced. Chronology, as even Beckett acknowledges, is not so easily cheated out of its rightful place in human life. Again, Turgenev's first love, which grows more poignant and subtle with every rereading, is the prototype that dictates the temporal form and not just the emotional content of subsequent treatments of first love. And I include among those subsequent treatments his own Spring Torrents, a work that represents, in the critical idiom of this conference, his own second thoughts about his earlier representation of first love. Both of these works, in fact, do not even bother to dispute that the first is an accident of chronology, a fateful accident, but an accident nonetheless. For Vladimir Petrovich, it is chronology that invests his love with a kind of fatefulness that would otherwise elude it. His love for Zinaida would not have left him so altered and finally so devastated had she not entered his life at the very moment when he was not only ready, but expecting something to happen that would transport him out of his aimless boyhood into a more manly, purposeful, and emotionally vital experience and existence. First love gives the vague, imperious longings that stirred his boyhood an object to serve and adore. And again, I was thinking, for those of you who saw the clip from A Letter to an Unknown Woman, this feeling that someone is waiting for the love to announce itself, a kind of intimation, I think contrasts very strongly Stefan's feeling of always waiting, perpetually waiting, but perpetually postponing the moment when the first love is actually acknowledged and greeted by him, to Vladimir, who is only not only ready, but willing to have first love announce itself and to respond to that announcement. Before Zinaida, that is, Vladimir remembers himself as a creature of pure but empty longing, quote, all expectancy and wonder, tremulous and waiting, unquote. Her arrival in his life puts an ending to his waiting and validates both his expectancy and his wonder as a genuine intimation, not an empty intuition. Emma Bovary, we might remember, is also afflicted by vaguely erotic presentiments, but chronology disobliges her. No accident stirs in her vicinity, so that in each desperate love that she tries to materialize, we may say that she is seeking the first, the ultimate, the great one. In this respect, I think first love is the favored child of the realist novel. For however melancholy the story of love it has to tell may be, it is never forced to question, as the lovers in realist novels always are, the power and validity, even the very existence of love, as the highest value and the ultimate maker of human destiny. Historically, first love emerges as a subject worthy of its own subgenre and a title, actually naming that subgenre, at the same time and as a kind of lyric counterpart and inset to the Bildungsroman, the most worldly and knowing of novelistic forms. In its worldliness, the Bildungsroman can absorb and subdue the energies and the hopes of first love into its more spacious and leisurely and perhaps cynical account of human formation. For after all, the Bildungsroman is rather pragmatic in its moral aim. It wants to demonstrate the necessity, if not the wisdom, of accommodating itself to the prevailing realities and laws of the world. First love, in face of such wisdom, practical wisdom, and opposition to its own ecstatic feeling, nonetheless refuses to relinquish its lyrical territory to the expediencies, the normalizing compromise formation that the Bildungsroman typically ratifies. We might say that, like all indulged offspring, first love insists on having its own way when it comes to the education of the heart, in saying what matters in the education of the heart. For the Bildungsroman, first love is an episode that may or may not matter, since the Bildungsroman cannot believe what first love's narratives base their very existence on, that such experience in itself has a power to form a character and decide a fate. These are somewhat, in fact, radically different versions of what human beings are and what they are genuinely, that is, spiritually and instinctively, long for. The intermingling of the Bildungsroman and first love narratives, which I think occurs often in the 19th century in particular, is usually mediated and attended by irony, of course, nowhere with more savage pity than in Dickens' Great Expectations, a novel in which the first love of the Bildungsroman uneasily shares the same psychological and narrative space. Pip, you remember, is the protagonist for whom first love, the first love for Estella, becomes a way of ascertaining who as well as where he should be in the social scale and ultimately in the moral scale of being. For Dickens, the social always sort of gravitates finally to the moral scale. He trusts to his first love for Estella to transport him out of the culture of lowness, that's his word, to which he initially condemns him when she pronounces him common and coarse and, quote, generally in a low-lived bad way, unquote. First love connects him in ways that he did not foresee, but will eventually appall him, to Magwitch's own dream of raising him to the status and to the stature of a high-living gentleman. Pip is so narratively, emotionally entangled in his determination to realize the great expectations, that is the plot of the Bildungsroman, to realize these great expectations imposed upon him, that his first love eventually is demoted from a foundational moment in his own life to a contributory theme, quote, a theme that so long has filled my heart. That's his judgment at the end of the novel. But for Stella, first love is not a theme, it is the very locus of value. It is Stella who has been schooled to exploit and pervert the heart's first affection. Stella, who in her last act or declaration as a heroine, separates first love from the energies, values, and objectives of the Bildungsroman plot, so mercilessly perverted in her own richly appointed but wretched life. There was a long, hard time, Stella tells Pip at their last but perhaps not final parting, when I kept from me the remembrance of what I had thrown away when I was quite ignorant of its worth. Since my duty now has not been incompatible with the admission of that remembrance, I have given it a place in my heart. I think Stella at this moment is understanding and communicating something very fundamental to the narratives of first love, and the particular primacy of the first in those narratives. The first, as she understands it, the first love, has a special place. It must in some ways be secluded out from all the time that sort of succeeds it. Because, in fact, it does have a marked chronological character. It marks the moment when feelings and sensations that, however anticipated but never experienced, actually do begin. But the first also comprises a spiritual and hierarchical dimension, indicating an elevation as well as the priority of certain feelings or events in the emotional life of men and women. What certainly seems incontestable is that so much prestige, and as with anything involving rank and prestige, so much anxiety attaches. Whether we are speaking about love of the first in time, at the point where things start or begin in earnest, or speaking of the first in terms of eminence in a hierarchy of feeling, both of these, in some sense, must be present. In first love, in fact, these two primary senses of the first are aligned in a new and powerful spiritual complex. This confusion, I think, is quite productive. It conducts the lover to the threshold of a new, more vital, and, for the moment, more exalted order of existence. In Spring Torrents, Turgenev explicitly compares this threshold to a barricade from which the youth, quote, sends its ecstatic greetings to the future, whatever it may hold, death or new life, no matter. This attitude, I might remark, is easy to mock. We might mock it, or we might dismiss it. It is also an attitude that can be converted, as Turgenev well knows in dramatizing the story, to more sinister, even perverted uses. In fact, this is actually what sort of happens. Sanin, the impressionable, ardent, but weak-willed protagonist who inspires this observation about love, first love, being a moment where you man the barricades and send out your ecstatic greetings to the future. Sanin, who inspires this remark, will eventually be seduced in the second half of the story by Maria Nikolaevna, the wealthy woman, here she comes, the wealthy woman, who we might say is the delicate in this story for all the adulterous worldly women of the realist novel, who must enjoy before they destroy the very innocence and idealism that attracts them. She speaks for them as much for herself when she tells Sanin, at once announcing and warning her intentions, "I am a reflective woman. It's amusing, and that's what our minds are for. But I never reflect about the consequences of anything I do myself. And when something goes wrong, I don't indulge in self-pity. Not that much. It's not worth it. I have a favorite saying, cela n'est-il pas de conséquence." She points out that there's no Russian equivalent for this very sort of Gallic sentiment. "And just so, what does tire a conséquence?" Unquote. Well, certainly nothing much for her. There is no question that Maria is a woman who keeps faith with her indifference. After she has wrecked Sanin's hope, she makes way to Paris and departs the precincts of the narrative that she has made so alluring and so dangerous, and needless to say, so knowing in the best modern way. But the narrative seems to take its revenge against her worldly indifference to consequences by failing to show any but the most perfunctory interest in what actually further happens to her. Her death comes almost as a kind of footnote to the story that she has such a large part in ironizing once that story concludes in its final and ultimately recuperative stage. This ending seems to expose and condemn Maria Nikolaevna's philosophy of inconsequence and moral indifference. So it is worth emphasizing again how different her notion of indifference is from the indifference enjoyed and promoted by the emotional highs of first love. It is the difference of things having no consequence, which is what she's saying, having no consequence, and finally things being of no consequence. Okay? A slight but important distinction. There are consequences of first love which are admitted, but ultimately from a position that we can survive them. Maria doesn't even have that notion of a future. To say that things have no consequence really condemns her to a kind of a demonic eternal presence. Her indifference reflects her moral rejection of the notion that the future is the time of reckoning, of accountability. She prides herself in being a reflective woman, but her reflections stop at first. They never extend to second thoughts. We can understand her indifference, the indifference of a free and calculating woman who puts herself beyond the reach of any judgment, even in death, when in fact she, according to her own logic, since she will no longer be herself, she no longer has anything to be caring about. So we can understand, perhaps, this kind of moral nihilism. But what is less easy to understand is the indifference of the first lover to the very future he or she so rapturously greets and intend to make their own. Why this indifference to the next moment, to the time to come? At the very moment when first love triumphs, when it seems that both the self and the world seem reborn and remade in hope and joy. We cannot dismiss this indifference to death, to the future, as assumed, or we cannot say that it reflects the lover's naivete, thus allowing the undermining presence of irony into the new world first love has created before it has a chance to establish and secure its existence. On the contrary, this blithe unconcern with the difference in the distance between first and last things is presented as first love's greatest psychic achievement, a surmounting of time and of transitoriness in a naive eternity in which Kierkegaard's Judge Wilhelm, the exponent of the ethical and the author of The Or and Either Or, this naive eternity in which he finds the true significance of first love.
Wie der Mythos der ersten Liebe auch mit Ende und mit Tod zusammenhängt, darüber spricht im heutigen Hörsaal die amerikanische Literaturwissenschaftlerin Maria De Battista. Sie hat sich am 27. Januar 2012 zusammen mit anderen Wissenschaftlern und Literaten im Rahmen der Tagung First Love on Second Thought mit der ersten Liebe auseinandergesetzt. Im ersten Teil ihres Vortrags befasst sie sich generell mit Darstellung der ersten Liebe in Texten von Beckett, Dickens oder Turgenev. Und in der zweiten Hälfte, die wir gleich hören, entwickelt sie die Idee der Gleichgültigkeit der ersten Liebe gegenüber Leben und Tod.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
So it's from the perspective of this naive eternity that time is invested with more and at the same time less meaning. A paradox that produces intriguing narrative possibilities. That first love is finally of no matter, and yet of the utmost importance, is a moral and spiritual fact acknowledged and mobilized with admirable dexterity in Turgenev's First Love. The novella begins with a disarming frame device that Rüdiger talked about. I want to return to that frame device and look at a little more closely at some of its detail to see how, in fact, as Rüdiger pointed out, it does provide a kind of oblique but a very essential structure, meta-narrative, in which to enter into the experience of first love as well. Again, just recall that it begins after a night of socializing, and there are three men that are left. One is the host of the evening, and the host all of a sudden suggests that they while away the last of their evening by telling the story of their first love. The first of the guests to take up the challenge, Sergei Nikolayevich, is described, importantly, as a round little man with a plump face. And I think these descriptions are important. The round little man with a plump face, I think, conjures up the figure who lives a relatively untroubled life, a life perhaps of fine pleasures, and certainly a life that does not seem troubled by conscience. So it is he who dismisses the very notion of first love, insisting that for him, again, there was no first love. I began with a second. He then explains that at 18 he began courting a young girl, quote, as if it was nothing new to me, exactly as I later flirted with others. Again, first love is inevitably repetitive, but I want to return back to these narrative beginnings. So what we see here is that Sergei dismisses the first, something that is inconsequential, of no consequence, but in fact has even been erased from his amatory history. Although he does, on second thought, so obliging to the theme of our conference, on second thought, he says, well, actually, I fell in love for the first and the last time when I was about 6 with my nurse. I do not remember the details of our relationship, and even if I did, how could they possibly interest anyone? At such moments like these, one cannot help feeling that Turgenev, much in the same manner as his young protagonist, is tremulous and waiting for someone to interest himself in such details. A Freud, for example, who would know the values of these details and what to make of them. I like to think, in fact, that Turgenev is bequeathing to Freud this tale of the nursery, details of which the good doctor would eventually elicit and interpret with his customary astuteness in ferreting out of the importance of our suppressed and life-defining memories. Then and only then might Sergei's plump face light up with surprising, perhaps an alarming recognition that he does indeed have a story to tell. Attention then reverts to the host, who, not bothering to conceal his disappointment that Sergei has nothing to convey, confesses that his tale, too, is soon told, that his first love with his present wife, that his love had crowned the marriage his family had arranged for him. Given his own experience, one might justifiably wonder why he proposed a topic for which there seemed to be so little to tell and even less to take seriously. But no sooner does the question arise than it is answered. Turgenev is the most considerate of novelists. For the host goes on to make a rather curious admission. He says that when he first proposed the topic of first love, he had trusted that the old bachelors would have the most to say, implying that the most reliable and the most interesting chroniclers of first love were those who had somehow never emotionally got beyond it, marital love being in some unspecified way antagonistic to first love, whose fervid, if dreamy, intensities cannot imagine, much less survive, the ordinary and everyday relationships that constitute married life. This, by the way, is the main and the principal objection to the ethical exponents of marriage. It goes from Kierkegaard's Professor Wilhelm, it's in Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving, Denise de Rougemont, Love in the Western World, of the idea that first love or any kind of passionate engagement finally refuses to subside in what I would call the novelistic, into the everydayness of relationships. And I thought it was very interesting that Stefan is self-identified as a hopelessly single man. So it's around this figure, this bachelor, this hopelessly single man, that it seems that first love narratives are attractive, as if there's something about first love narratives that, in fact, are a species of survivor narratives. The host may have some intimation of this. At any rate, I think that this expectation, the host's expectation that the single man, the bachelor, is the one with the story to tell, is a very interesting one and makes us wonder whether this expectation is the expectation of a sophisticated man or of a careless, because happy, man. We must remember that it's the host of the evening, and by extension of the narrative, who admits this governing assumption into the story, and that in some ways it serves Turgenev's purpose to isolate the bachelor as the one whose experience cannot have been ordinary, that is, an experience that has been worth telling. The bachelor, in fact, is willing to oblige, to play the game of narrative forfeits, just as 30 years earlier, we later find out, he played so willingly Zenaida's parlor game of forfeits, a game that cunningly combines, as the story does, the idea of voluntary surrender, penalty, and redemption. But the narrator, Vladimir, puts certain conditions on acquiescing to this request and paying his forfeit. He insists, first of all, that he not tell the story, that he write it. He offers an excuse that he is a poor storyteller, that his stories often come out when told as too bald and dry, or else much too long and quite unreal. I think behind these aesthetic considerations lie, of course, emotional values. First love is sensitive to time, so its recollection must neither be too short nor too long. First love, more importantly, demands its own style. Cannot be bald and dry, but it must be suffused with the warmth of surging life. And most importantly, it must communicate a sense of felt and immediate reality. Well, the story, as Vladimir proceeds to tell it, is enfolded and then finally entangled and ultimately displaced by a first love that is more imperious, more demanding, ultimately more legendary and mythic than his own. He falls in love with Zenaida, but the story soon yields to the story of Zenaida's love for Vladimir's own father. Now, the Oedipal character, one could say the Oedipal inevitability of Vladimir's story, is undeniable, but it only counts for Vladimir's story and leaves the central and tragic narrative, in which, in fact, the moral drama is concentrated, unaccounted for. This moral drama does not play out, I think, according to the psychological laws of Oedipal rivalry and triangulated mediated desire, as they have been discovered and expounded by Freud and René Girard, our foremost interpreters of desire and the myriad vicissitudes and deceits. The Girardian triangulations of desire, in fact, play no role in the mythic or the ultimate first love story of Zenaida and her father. Rather, these mediations are, in fact, you could say banished, or at least they're confined, to the more novelistic and the kind of tragic comic subplot of Zenaida's playful management of her rivalrous suitors, each of whom represents a different profession and a different attitude towards love and towards her. There's the poet who sublimates his love, the doctor who diagnoses it, but cannot in fact cure himself of it, the soldier who defends it and aggressively pursues it, the Polish count who in a sense seems to represent the aristocratic entitlement to having everyone succumb to his will. So it's these characters that kind of circle around Zenaida and suggest a possible kind of novelistic plot of mediated desire. But in fact, the story, while it gestures to that plot, enfolds it, is entangled in it, doesn't really answer to the moral heart of the story themselves. That story is centered on Zenaida and Vladimir's father, who, interestingly enough, feel no prior fascination with or spiritual need of the sublimities of passionate love, but rather avoid it as a threat to their own integrity of character. They prefer to cultivate a particular kind of knowledge, the knowledge, as Vladimir's father says, of how to want. Knowing how, not just what to want, is, of course, the knowledge exemplified and in classical Oedipal fashion monopolized by the father. And in fact, in the story, Vladimir's father, in one of his rare moments of affability, condescends to impart that knowledge to his son. Take what you can for yourself, and don't let others get you into their hands. To belong to oneself is the whole thing in life. And later he will say, in asking his son, do you want to know what the meaning of liberty is? He says, the meaning of liberty is will, your own will. And it gives power which is better than liberty. Know how to want, and you'll be free, and you'll be master. These are not the remarks, I think, of a cynical man, but rather of a man who puts himself first. I mention them here because I think it's important, ironic, and fundamental that for all of his knowing how to want, that this knowledge will prove unavailing once he experiences for the first time what it means to love. His knowledge is not just discredited, but surrendered, along with the riding whip that he sort of carries throughout the story as a sort of symbol of his sort of masculine mastery over his passions. Zenaida's knowledge is altogether darker and deals with mythic rather than more sort of Oedipal scenarios of sexual surrender and self-disillusion, scenarios that culminate in a fantasy that she elaborates of yielding herself and her fate to Bacchantes, who will proceed to tear her to pieces. Zenaida shares with Vladimir's father a desire for self-mastery, but she is more willing and even more reckless in committing herself to defeat in the cause of love. And at one point towards the end of the narrative, she identifies with Cleopatra and the very notion of a world well lost. Now, Vladimir comes, in some sense, to observe, to follow, to try to understand his love in the context of the love that is unfolding between Zenaida and his father. And the story, in fact, I think anticipates the narrative strategies of Henry James, where, again, the teller of the story is obliquely situated towards the actual center of the narrative, which is never finally fully disclosed. We only get at the narrative through this kind of oblique indirection. But that itself seems to me worth commenting on. It signals that Vladimir finally comes to recognize what? He recognizes that ultimately he's at the periphery, not at the center of this story of first love, a love that gradually modulates from a comic into a tragic irony, an irony epitomized in the question that repeats itself in various registers without ever being satisfactorily answered in the course of the narrative. It is the question Zenaida puts to him most directly. This is where it comes. I love you, she says, and you haven't an inkling why and how much I love you. That is, I love you, you don't know what form it takes, you don't even know the extent of it. But anyhow, what is it that you know? I think that is the central question of first love. What is it that you know? Whatever Vladimir thinks he does know is pitifully meager, an inkling, as Zenaida puts it, of what her love is and what it represents. Her question, the question that drives the narrative of discovery, is, as I said, never definitively answered. in place of an answer, we have a recognition of the limits of worldly knowledge, the knowledge, that is, of how to want, knowledge of how to want, and a knowledge of the self that would live according to that knowledge. So that the narrative, having reached the sense of the limits of first love, all of a sudden switches attention not from the foundations of first love, but to the end of first love, the last things. And here I will be introducing a presence that, for the first time, I guess, in this consideration, it's the presence of death, not as a kind of sanctification, but of a different kind of presence in the narrative of first love, the last thing. The story of first love, as Turgenev tells us, in fact, has two endings. The first, we could say, is the kind of novelistic ending, which recounts how the triangle of Vladimir, his father, and Zenaida kind of disperses and falls apart. The father goes off to St. Petersburg, dies soon after. Zenaida will go on to marry but die in childbirth. And Vladimir survives the narrative in some sense as its kind of custodian of the knowledge whose value and even whose content he doesn't quite understand. But then there's a second ending, and it suggests a different kind of redirection that first love narratives are always in some sense trying to insinuate. It comes when, in fact, Vladimir is at the deathbed of an old woman. And it's not a woman who has anything to do with the story at all. Well, let's call it kind of a novelistic scenario. He just happens on to be present at the death of this old woman and begins to marvel at the strength of her bodily resistance to her approaching end. This is what he said. She had seen no joy in her life, had never tasted the honey of happiness. Why, then I thought, shouldn't she be glad of death, of its freedom and its peace? And yet, so long as her frail body still struggled, so long as her chest rose and fell agonizingly beneath the ice-cold hand resting on it, so long as her final strength remained, the old woman went on crossing herself and whispering, "Dear God, forgive me my sins." And it was only with the last spark of consciousness that there vanished from her eyes the look of fear and horror at her approaching end. And I remember that as I stood there beside the deathbed of that poor old woman, I began to feel terrified for Zenaida, and I felt I wanted to pray for her, for my father, and for myself. Vladimir, I would venture, is not terrified at the prospect of death, however awful, in the full sense of that word, death might see. He seems to be terrified by the prospect of final judgment, of the final disclosure of all things. The actual content of his prayer is perhaps less important than the moment of grace that attends and sanctifies it. I take this moment of grace to be that moment wherein finally he includes Zenaida, his father, and himself in a kind of trinity that is purged of all of the confusions, of all of the rivalries, of all of the hurts of triangulated desire, a trinity which in fact is willing to confess its own unknowingness and accept them as a kind of new social unit. There's a beautiful architecture of the poem, of the narrative. It begins with three men, and it ends with, in fact, this reconstituted unit that are really joined, almost as if this is a new kind of society and a new way of thinking about how people might be related to each other. I just want to conclude by saying that this revulsion against both the struggle to live and against the terrors of death represents a different spiritual and emotional complex than the, quote, secret preference for what is unhappy, unquote, that Denise de Rougemont discerned as the motive of the Tristan romance, the key myth, he would have it, of love in the Western world. First love, I would say, is not a myth that expresses what de Rougemont calls the sadistic genius of the Western psyche with its, quote, repressed longing for death, for self-experience to the utmost, for the revealing shock, a longing which beyond question manifests the most tenacious root of the war instinct we nourish, unquote. That passionate love does not spring from the deepest instincts for life, but is rather a sadistic vicissitude of the war instinct, is a proposition, I think, that still has the power to offend, if not disoblige, our belief that Eros inspires and consecrates an equally tenacious longing for unity, harmony, and happiness, at least for forgiveness at the end of First Love story of Turgenev. First Love is the myth that comes to the defense of this belief in Eros at a time when it seems the most vulnerable. It is worth remarking that de Rougemont first undertook his study in the mid-1930s and revised it in 1954, and he offered it as a reflection on what had happened in love in the Western world as it had entered a period of pronounced and probably final and irreversible decline. He describes this period as the time in which, quote, wandering libidos in quest of new spheres of activity, unquote, often found their new activities in totalitarian cults of the leader. Everything that a totalitarian education withheld from individuals was heaped upon the personified nature, de Rougemont warns. He concludes at last by scything, as he puts it, with moderation. And this is like going to leave this as a sort of possible way in which passionate love actually connects back with, as he describes it, with first love. We are unendingly and incessantly in the thick of the struggle between nature and grace, unendingly and incessantly unhappy and then happy. But the horizon does not remain the same. A fidelity maintained in the name of what does not change as we change will gradually disclose some of its mystery. Beyond tragedy, another happiness waits. A happiness resembling the old, but no longer belonging to the form of the world, for this new happiness transforms the world, unquote. It seems to me that this happiness, and happiness which resembles the old happiness but no longer belongs to the form of the world, unhappiness that transformed the world, sounds very much like the anthem and the procedures of the outcomes of first love, whose happiness experienced as a revolutionary transformation of the self, of its world. A value, a world, a love which apprehends and exists in a naive eternity where things do not change, even if we change. Could then one of the names that does not change be the name of first love? Thank you.
Die erste Liebe ist indifferent gegenüber dem Tod. Diesen Gedanken verfolgte für uns die Literaturwissenschaftlerin und Princeton-Professorin Maria De Battista mit Texten von Beckett, Turgenev und anderen Autoren, die die erste Liebe zum Thema gemacht haben. Ihr Vortrag First Love and Last Things wurde am 27. Januar 2012 aufgezeichnet, und zwar vom Einstein Forum Potsdam, das eine Tagung zum Thema Erste Liebe veranstaltet hatte, mit dem Titel First Love on Second Thought. Sinngemäß übersetzt Erste Liebe auf den zweiten Blick.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.